Hi, everybody. My name's Chris, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 21st, 1988, and the Midtown Group in Washington, D.C., that's my home group. And thank you very much for the introduction and the invitation to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA with all my heart, and I by no means consider myself a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous. However, I am a huge advocate of this way of life. I love the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsorship, home group, and of course, I mentioned my sobriety date. And the introduction, I well-rounded, where I come from, when you call somebody well-rounded, you're calling them a little fat. that might be true. I think that is true. I was out this morning surfing with my friends, and I don't throw things away, and I got my old swim trunks that I've had for a long time, and they just don't fit right. So, but I'm out there still surfing, and just I've had a wonderful day. I have lots of wonderful gifts, and if you're new, that's just probably going to thrill the hell out of you that I have all these wonderful gifts and such a great life. And no, I'm just kidding. Didn't thrill me at all when I was new. But one thing I did, I have to mention, is that, as I said, my sobriety date, July 21st of 1988, and just celebrated 18 years of sobriety, which is pretty amazing. And that's that means I've been sober much more than half of my life, about 3 years more, if you want to do the math. And what that means is that I haven't taken anything from the neck up, and I haven't taken any drugs or alcohol to change my mood. Not once. Not while nobody was looking. Not while, you know, I was on vacation. No near beer. No nothing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous because what it's given me and what that means and the significance of that means is that I'm still alive after 18 years of not drinking. And in many meetings, How It Works is read, Chapter 5, out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what it talks about is, it says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. And it goes through the three pertinent ideas, which are really kind of, I guess, stepping stones of experience of the typical alcoholic. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God couldn't would if he were sought. And I don't just memorize this because it's read in every meeting. Perhaps I memorized it because of osmosis. I don't know. I'm not a big book memorizer. It's just something that sticks out in my head. But there's a part in there that was the key to my survival after a year of sobriety, and I'll share that with you. I'll just cut right to the chase, and I'll tell you all about my drinking. Most definitely, I did do some drinking. But this is the part that saved my life, and that's why I like to give it right up front. In that description, it talks about the before and after. The before and after what was the thing that I didn't... I would just read it and just go right on through, pass it right on by. But the significance of before and after says that I'm an alcoholic no matter what I do. Before I drink and after I drink. That I am an alcoholic through and through. Those three pertinent ideas are as true today for me as they were the day I started drinking. The day I began to drink alcoholically, at least. And the reason why that's significant is because I always wanted to know, God, what the hell's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? People would ask me, what's wrong with you? And I would answer with a question, what is wrong with me? I don't understand. And it wasn't when I was drinking. I was being asked that question sober or drunk. And asked myself that. It got worse when I got sober. My life got immensely worse from as far as the quality of my thinking. I mean, I just went completely nuts every time I tried to stay sober. And that's the significance of what I was just talking about. Is that what alcohol did for me is exactly what makes me an alcoholic. You see, the before and after, there was a very distinct phase. After about three drinks, what would happen, and this is the characterization, this is the nature of my drinking, is that after about three drinks, something in me would calm down and settle. And I could again begin to breathe and just relax and just and the table would stop shaking, and I wouldn't have to do quite this as much. The tops of my jeans started to get dry from rubbing my hands. And I suddenly began to feel the way you looked. And your outsides didn't really matter to me. Yeah, you had more money, you had more this, you had more that, but I felt okay. And that was after three drinks, because I would turn my head and everything would have that nice little hazy, fuzzy, happy thing. You know, it was almost like a kaleidoscope, but it was a really desirable picture of a kaleidoscope. Now, you could look at a horrible bloody mess through a kaleidoscope, but it just looks interesting. Wow. You take that away, and it's like, oh my God, call 911. And that's really what drinking did for me. That's what drinking did for me. And although I didn't realize it at the time, I could drink a whole lot in a short amount of time. As I said, I got sober, and I'm working backwards from my story intentionally. As I said, I got sober July 21st of 1988. And I got sober under circumstances which are just very unexciting. As a matter of fact, run the risk of perhaps, kind of taken away from some of the credit of the power of this program. Really, what happened was my mom dropped me off at rehab and she didn't come back to pick me up. My mom dropped me off in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's really all there is to it. There's nothing really else more to it. Now, I drank a whole lot and I got in a lot of trouble, but she just got done with my silliness. She drove me right down to Arlington Hospital, and I was at the dentist. There's some significance there, but I was at the dentist 1 minute. The next minute, we're in the car. The bags are packed in the back, and I'm going through intake, being asked a lot of really nosy questions from this very large woman. Everything seemed large, I guess, but this woman was asking me all kinds of questions. Then I'm going through this strip search. What is this? And then next thing I know, I'm playing ping pong with a guy that was self-professed black belt in karate. If I tried anything, he was going to beat my ass. But he was really good at ping pong. And he was laughing and told me how glad he was I was there. I smiled, said the same thing. Yeah, I'm glad I'm here too. Funny thing is it was an interesting environment. I didn't really mind. Because during the intake, they told me, like, you have to fill out this menu. And you fill it out for the next day, and you submit it in here, and it has to be in by 9, otherwise they're going to get a generic meal. And then they showed me to my room, and it's a room with, like, 4 or 5 other folks. And the people that I saw, I mean, they looked like people. The people in the rehab I went to actually really looked pretty cool. They looked like people I would love to hang out with. And they were. I loved being institutionalized. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Now, I was a little bit bummed out. Once the detox gets going, then things change. But at least initially, I'm like, all right, this is all right. I just got to fill out my menu and get better at ping pong. And the thing is they give us, and the books that they gave us during the intake was Living Sober, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text of another program, Where and When's for just about everything, and all kinds of really great assignments, and I got my treatment plan. And then I had to meet with this counselor to develop this treatment plan. And that was the nature of my rehab. The one thing that saved my life out of all of that, and the one really wonderful thing, was that they loaded the van full of all of us, and they took us to all kinds of meetings. And I found out the reason why they took us to all different types of meetings, other than just Alcoholics Anonymous, is they only had one van. That was it. But we went to all kinds of meetings. But I'll tell you what, I found in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I loved it. You smoked lots of cigarettes. You could smoke anywhere, everywhere. People loved to give people cigarettes. They were cheap. Coffee, I loved coffee. I loved cigarettes. Hearing horrifically wonderful stories, just amazing tales of just terrible, destructive things, and everybody's laughing at these horrifically awful things that happen to them, and they are quite funny. And these just terrific stories of, you know, slaughtering animals. I mean, just really, it was fantastic. And then every once in a while, there would be, back then, there would be a Vietnam story thrown in there, and maybe a Korean War, and, you know, whatever else, just awesome stories. But now keep in mind that, you know, there I was, and I'm viewing this as, okay, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous is. You sit in meetings, you smoke cigarettes, and that's it. Well, I was a carbon copy of about, during any given, probably that year, that same rehab, it was flipping through communities of, 50 and 60 folks. Every 6 weeks, there's probably 200 treatment centers identically like it in Northern Virginia. Needless to say, there were tons of us flooding into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Flooding. And this is significant, too. Because we just absolutely were hell-bent on destroying beautiful meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, just tons of history, a wealth of history, and people that had really just been in nice groups and took care of their meeting and had great relationships with the church. All of a sudden, scores of us would just flood into these meetings. And we just had our ideas of what Alcoholics Anonymous was, and to us it was just a bunch of cigarettes, maybe some motorcycles and nice cars and doing what we wanted to do. And eventually we found it that we just didn't hang out in the meeting. It was much more interesting outside the meeting than hanging in the meeting. Well, I'll step back just a little bit and let you know that what I found is one of the most beautiful things about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that the members indeed did not have to do anything to jeopardize their own sobriety by getting resentful. You see, AA is very much a self-cleaning oven. And one by one, I didn't have any more friends. And then I ended up getting a sponsor who was somebody that was sitting in the meeting and somebody that was working the 12 steps. I mention all of those things right off the bat to let you know that I'm not standing here before you out of any virtue. That I did drink, and I drank alcoholically. Staying sober is one of the worst states that I've ever been in. I hit my bottom, and that is to the point where I was suicidal when I was stone cold sober. That's my beginning, my middle, and the end. And that's, in a general way, what I was like, what happened, and of course I'll be happy to tell you alongside of what I'm like today. But that, in a nutshell, is what the nature of my drinking is. I didn't do a lot of drugs. My drug of choice was really your beer. My drug of choice is really whatever you were doing. That was really my drug of choice, and the people I hung out with happened to drink. Now, I started drinking when I was about 11 years old. And I can remember as far back as the sixth grade feeling different. And the reason why I say that is because I really, really was different. I know some people say that, but no, I remember back in the sixth grade. I look around the sixth grade. There I was in the sixth grade. You see, I had yellow teeth. Yellow teeth. I had enamel hypoplasia, and really, I just, in some places and then in others, there was no enamel on my teeth, so they just were bright yellow. It's a pretty painful thing when you're a little kid and your pulp's all exposed and you can't drink cold stuff and it looks like you never brush your teeth. You get a lot of ridicule. So there I was with yellow teeth. Well, that caused a lot of problems. Now, they told me I had a learning disability, that I had difficulty learning how to read. So then I had to go to this special class, a speech class, as a matter of fact, where they give you batteries of tests, scores and scores of tests, where they just constantly probe you for what might be the missing link. You know, that missing thing. I felt very fragmented all the time. So there I am, I'm fragmented ideology. So this caused a lot of stress in your life. It caused a little bit of, digestional problems. So there I was, I had an ulcer, and I'm going to a urologist and a proctologist, getting upper GIs and lower GIs, drinking barium in the sixth grade, going to get pictures taken. That's really fun. Random doctors checking me out in places that I don't think they're supposed to check you out in the sixth grade, and there I was, and that'll cause problems. So then the proctologist discovers I have lots of hemorrhoids. So there I am in the sixth grade. I have yellow teeth. I'm in the retarded class. I have hemorrhoids. Now, I can't do my homework because I have a learning disability, and the teacher won't give me a sticker because in order to get a sticker, you have to do your homework, and it has to be done all completed on Friday. Otherwise, you don't get a sticker. So there I am. I can't do my homework. I'm retarded. I've got yellow teeth. My hemorrhoids are very painful. I'm drinking barium, which is nuclear. They've got x-rays of me in weird places, and I've got like 11 doctors. Now in comes a shrink. So now they're taking me to a shrink. I've got all this stuff. And interestingly enough, if I could go back and I was the original doctor, I would have saved my parents so much money. I would have saved them thousands and thousands and thousands of shrink bills and doctor bills and everything. What I would have done, if I wanted to save them, at least in the short term, is gone out, bought a fifth of Jack Daniels, poured 3 shots, handed it to that little kid, taken him, and he just would have been fine. The homework would have been no problem. The learning disability magically disappears. The reason why I say that is because when I started drinking, those things went away. Those things actually all got better. All got better. My father was a self-professed alcoholic as I was growing up. He stopped drinking, according to my mother, before I could remember, although he did drink quite a bit. He had that under control. That whole drinking thing was kind of a phase for him. But he never went to church with us. My mom would trek us all to church, me, my brother, and my sister. I'm the youngest of three. My brother's 7 years older. My sister's 8 years older than I am. Today we're wonderful, wonderful friends. But my mother would trek us all to church. Little did I know, my sister's getting high in the bathroom. My father's jacked up on a ton of just antidepressant, narcotics at the time, which seems like, of course, antidepressant, narcotics, same thing. Well, back then it was kind of a new thing, the whole Dalmaine, antibarbiturate era. But they had lots of fun with medication with my father, and he was a diabetic, and he was an alcoholic, and he was on all these pills, and this is right around the time I was drinking, and when I say started drinking, I mean every time I drank to get drunk, and I would lose the ability for the amount that I took in. So that's what I characterize as starting drinking, and really I would drink anything. It didn't matter. Remember those boxes of wine you could buy? I think they still have them. I don't know. But those were awesome. Those just hit the suburbs like crazy. And that's where I lived, out in Reston, Virginia. And they hit the suburbs, and all my friends' parents started getting them. The reason why we loved them is because they couldn't mark the lines on the boxes. Nobody was going to get a scale and weigh their box. They just set up like 5 boxes, And we'd go there with old coffee cans and fill up these boxes and stuff, baby bottles and sippy cups and all kinds of stuff, and then run off into the woods and pop this stuff open and drink it. And it was amazing elixir. That's what my drinking was characterized by. Every once in a while, we'd try and smoke something or sniff something or eat something. My father had a physician's desk reference. I thought, how convenient. He's a heart patient, diabetic, had all kinds of stuff. So, we had all the pharmaceuticals and all that stuff. So needless to say, my mother, we went from going to church to my mother would pack up the car and we'd all go to Al-Anon and Alateen. Because my father's an alcoholic and there's my sister. Turns out my sister's not drinking Sprite, she's drinking vodka. And when she's 17, she completely loses her mind. Evidently, she had an enlarged fatty liver and was going through DTs, seeing things during her detox. And they didn't know she was detoxing, they thought she was just dying. Turns out she was detoxing. So next thing I know, my sister's in rehab. And my father, shortly thereafter, it all kind of comes together. Meanwhile, I'm drinking all the while. My sister gets out of rehab, and then she decides to detox my father on the front couch. So there's my father flopping around. And then they're both, like, smoking cigarettes together. And it just didn't fit the image. There's my father smoking, detox. And there's my sister, like, going to her AA meeting. She was a cheerleader. We live in Reston, Virginia. This is not happening. Next thing I know, I'm going to Alateen. And my mother's telling me about all these chances I have of becoming an alcoholic. 80% chance, Chris. 80%. If you don't start drinking now, you might have a shot at not becoming. I just want you to understand, here's what alcoholism is. And all of a sudden, like, we went from reading, like, Super Fudge, Judy Blume books. Now we're reading Under the Influence. And I'm just getting this wealth of information. Like, what's happening? And so then my sister becomes a rehab counselor. All the while, I still have the shrink. All the while, I'm still getting drunk on the weekends and taking and doing whatever it is I can, because my case is different. I loved the meetings of Alateen back then, but I didn't love them for the message that they had. I loved them because, really, it was a place where you could just go hang out until like 11 o'clock on a school night, and that's where it started. Eventually, those went by the wayside, and I went my own way, and I started doing my own thing, and I hated my parents. I hated my sister. Just couldn't stand it. As a matter of fact, I became very, very introverted on the outside, but on the inside, I was just going crazy. I was just going crazy because what was happening was that just by circumstance, my father started getting very sick. He had a heart attack when I was in the third grade, and he would occasionally just keel over and die, is what would happen. And what that means is he would have a massive coronary, and then it would either be, you know, something big with his heart would go down. He didn't take care of himself. He was a closet smoker, and, you know, he was doing all these other drugs, I guess, at the time. And anyway, I would have these forced periods of sobriety where, and I didn't recognize it then, but I would just get totally caught up in my head. And just, I'd have no outlet, and I was just forced to help Mom take care of Dad, and I didn't have anything to drink, and, you know, we're going all these places, and, you know, it just... these periods seemed to get longer and longer. And I remember every single one of those periods because all that stuff that I was talking about that was happening in the sixth grade started really kicking up. I just couldn't concentrate. I couldn't do well in school. I was depressed, as it were. And then I'd go out and drink and everything would get better. I had a shrink that was totally onto this and knew. He still has a wonderful man. He works, I think he lives overseas now in Japan, but at the time, he was able to identify alcoholism in young people before it was really even acceptable in any community. We stumbled on this shrink because it was somebody who my sister had come into contact with. And my sister told him a little bit about me and talked to my mom and said, listen, you've got a dangerous situation here. And so he became my psychologist and psychiatrist, and he knew all about my drinking. The interesting thing was he never told me not to drink. What he told me was to pay attention. Pay attention to what you're experiencing when you're drinking. This guy's awesome. I could tell him anything, and he wasn't ratting me out either. He was to pay attention to what happens to when you're drinking. Think about it. And early on, I started blacking out, and I'd tell him about that. He's like, yeah, that's interesting. That only happens to alcoholics. Be like, well, all right, I'll just drink less. He's like, yeah, try that. that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen at all. He sent me away to this place. He gave me this job at this retreat center where I was to absolutely hit my bottom. 6 months before... He had suggested me I become a lifeguard, and that seemed cool. Well, he sent me off to this place where I was kind of in this controlled environment, and we had unlimited access to alcohol. Now, this guy is the coolest guy in the world. This shrink put me in a position where there I was with, like, all these camp counselors. I'm 14 at the time. He told me to lie about my age, and I was much taller. Probably the same height I was since I was 13. As a matter of fact, I've just kind of stayed tall. But I lied about my age. He got me into this place. He was the Episcopal. It turns out he's a priest. Episcopal priest. And he gets me into this place. And sure enough, there I am with unlimited supply of alcohol. And I was in seventh heaven. Once again. Interesting thing is that those periods where I could no longer deal with sobriety became shorter and shorter. The frequency of my drinking got closer and closer together. So indeed, on Wednesdays, I would be in a blind rage and have no idea why. Everything hurt. My teeth hurt. The hounds of fate are nipping at my heels. People were just very obnoxious, nice people especially. And people would talk to me about starting to, you know, chill out on my drinking. Because when I would drink over the weekend, I would drink a whole lot in a short amount of time. Well, that summer ended, and I went back to school the following year, and my parents decided that the problem was my environment, so they moved us out to the land of fruits and nuts, in my opinion. It was way out into the country of Sterling, Virginia, from Reston. Well, to me, that was on the other side of the globe. I mean, I may as well be in Idaho, as far as I knew. That's where Sterling was. And they got me a moped, and there I had my shrink, and I went through that year, and I lost my mind completely that year. Everything went absolutely downhill. I had no friends at all. I hated people. I became suicidal. My parents made a pretty severe mistake. They bought me. They wanted me to be more like my brother and hang out with my brother. And so my brother was dating a girl in Winchester who family was big into hunting. So my parents bought me a shotgun. Right? Just if you're deciding to reproduce and you're a member here, might not be the best decision to try and get your son out of a depression by purchasing him a shotgun. Just a happy suggestion, but they bought me a shotgun. I know they love me, so I know it was not an intentional thing, at least as far as I know. But they buy me the shotgun, right? And so on Wednesdays, sure enough, there I'd hit the Wednesdays. The only time I could drink is on the weekends or maybe every 3 weeks. And as the intervals got longer, the further distance apart between the times I was drinking, the absolute more bizarre I got. And so I became extremely suicidal and homicidal. I became obsessed with it. I developed a level of insomnia where I just couldn't sleep. All I could do was just think. And it just felt like the wind was constantly blowing through my gut, and I just became afraid of things that were just absolutely asinine. I got terrified that I had the disease of AIDS. The reason why I say that is because I experienced all the symptoms of AIDS. I started breaking out in these little things all over my body, started bleeding from picking at stuff. Is that it? Is that it? Is that it? And then I'd pick it and I'd start bleeding. I would have night sweats, constantly night sweats. I would just all of a sudden just break out in day sweats as you couldn't believe. My temperature would rise and fall. I would throw up, just vomit for no particular reason. It was crazy. Now, I do have to tell you that in order to pick up the HIV virus, you have to do something either reasonably exciting or have something happen to you. A foreign body enter your body that's previously touched somebody else that's had the HIV. Now, we know all that now. I was an expert. I became an expert in the HIV virus. You see, there was and I had the percentage down. Had I shaken your hand and you had a hangnail and I had a cut finger, there is a possibility of this and that. I went through all this and I just became obsessed with this. They knew my name at the hotline. The AIDS hotline. It was reasonably new. They knew my name. They knew everything about me. I just became obsessed with this. When I was drinking, all of a sudden that stuff would vanish. But then, periods of sobriety, I just became obsessed and terrified of this. I was so afraid of dying, I wanted to blow my head off. And then it was time for the summer again, and they sent me off to that same camp again, and that stuff magically disappeared, and then I just became God's own angry drunk. Where I would just get really, really drunk, not realize what I was doing. And now my drinking had progressed to the point where when I would start drinking, I would drink until my body could no longer handle it. I would actually OD almost every time I drank. I was a terrible person to drink with. People hated drinking with me. I mean, it was entertaining for like the first 20 minutes, but I mean, I'm puking up weird colors and, you know, just screaming and just, and I wouldn't remember any of it. Now, the interesting thing is after a period of drinking like that, I would wake up the next morning and have absolutely no hangover. My voice was a little bit hoarse, but other than that, that's about it. And I never experienced a hangover. I found out later what that is in prehab. My body really likes alcohol. It's just so conditioned. It loves the acetaldehyde. It loves all the little byproducts of alcohol. It just metabolizes all of it, so there's nothing left. And that's the nature of my drinking. I love drinking. I love drinking. I loved what alcohol did for me. The problem was sobriety became unbearable. That before and after I was talking about is exactly the thing that saved my life. You see, I'd stayed sober in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on and off for the first year, as I said, and I told you the story of what I was like and what happened. But you understand that what I'm like now is in a very dramatic dramatic difference to what I should be like. The reason why I say that is 18 years without drinking, I could barely go 1 month without completely losing my mind. But today, I'm not suicidal. I'm not extremely violently rageful, angry. Things happen, yeah. I'm not the most virtuous, you know, kind, loving, understanding man that I could be. I'm working on it, but I have a sponsor to help me with that stuff. But I'm not suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And what I mean by suffering is there's a number of ways that people talk about that. What I found out suffering from alcoholism is called white-knuckle sobriety, is what they used to call it when I started coming around. But I started paying attention to people that were truly happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you can see it in their eyes. It has nothing to do with what they're saying. The most simple men, one of the most happiest men I've ever known in my life, came from not too far from here. I was thinking about it, and I'm going to share a little bit about him. He's dead now, but he's an amazing example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. It was a man by the name of Earl Chess. I don't know if you remember him. For those of you that have been sober a number of years, you might remember the guy that would do your tapes. Earl Chess is one of my favorite human beings ever. My wife used to do tapes with him at Saturday Morning Live. And he'd talk about all of us that were getting sober. And he was amazingly patient. He'd talk about us as his babies. He wasn't my sponsor. He's just a man that I happened to watch. And his eyes would smile. And his wife, Barbara, she's an angel. Absolute angel. She would let him get in his van and go off. And he'd just go make tapes. And that's all he did. And that was his business. And, you know, whatever. If you think he's making money out of Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, go by his house, take a look at his basement, how he did it. I assure you, it was not a profit-sharing model. What it was a model for him to stay as close to Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as he possibly could. And he grew to love all kinds of wonderful people. And he just, a lot of people knew him from the area. And he just traveled. In taping Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, he wanted to stay that close. And I would watch people like Earl, and I would watch the things they did. I don't do taping today. I don't have a basement as a recording studio or anything like that. But what I watched was, I watched what he did, and he did what he said he was going to do, and he would be where he said he was going to be. A very simple guy. He never spoke in very deep, esoteric things. And all the people that I've truly loved, and that I know have experienced joy through this fellowship, are much the same way. We're reading in the third step, and we were reading it on the way here, on the way back from the beach. And the third step talks about the love, in the 12 and 12, talks about willingness as being the key. And that's it. And you understand. And what I found out was, is that I'd always felt fragmented, or I'd always felt, like I told you, just kind of like that sixth grade thing. It's just, I always felt like I was a quart low. There was something missing. Something's not there. That somehow you were going to have a spiritual experience much more profound than I ever could. That you just had that missing ingredient, and that's why you're happy, but I'm miserable because something's missing. And what I was doing was, I was just pulling the whole victim stuff. And I found out something interesting sober, and this almost cost me my life. Is that my life is my fault, and my sobriety is my responsibility. That I'm not a victim of any of that stuff. I wasn't a victim of anything, any message from the Catholic Church. People used to love saying that, as I'm a recovering Catholic. You know, and the Catholic Church told me this and gave me all this guilt. And perhaps that might be true, but in my case, what it was I interpreted and I picked out little things that I wanted to hear. And turned that around and, you know, said that I'm a bad person because of this, or my case is different because of this. And what I found out was that ego took two faces, either better than or absolutely worse than that. But they're both two sides of the ego, and that's why I kept bouncing back and forth. And the information itself isn't what changed me. The self-knowledge didn't really give me anything. What gave me something was that taking action in here was the key. You train your feet you bring the body and the mind to follow. To me, those were just words early on. But once I got to the third step and followed through on the level of willingness, I didn't ever had to ask what the first step and second step really meant. When people talked about insanity, I never really said, well, what do you mean insane? I absolutely knew what they were talking about. If anything, I thought I was insane and perhaps not alcoholic, where unmanageability and powerlessness were the same idea. But once I was put in a position of the third step and found pages 60 to 64 and understood what that willingness in action was, that it was more than just a decision. It was actually training your feet. It was actually showing up, making the coffee, making the commitment, setting up the chairs. I learned how to start taking care of some of those meetings we were hell-bent on destroying. I looked around, and there was no home group. I heard a guy speak. Actually, I heard a woman speak first, who just absolutely—I just understood what she was talking about. And she spoke a million miles an hour. A woman by the name of Karen Garrison, who's a good friend, but she just told some awesome stories. And really, she had a love for Alcoholics Anonymous, and the stories were interesting, and the stories were like pretty funny. But what I could tell was that she just had this zest for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it turns out her sponsor, I got to hear him a little while later, and I found out there's this whole different side to what Alcoholics Anonymous can bring. And what my now sponsor talks about is called happy-ass sobriety. And he would talk to me about two types of sobriety. There's sad-ass sobriety, and there's happy-ass sobriety. Other people I met, Hal Marley, Dr. Hal Marley, would talk about the attitude of gratitude. And old Hal was awesome, but I started following all these guys around. And I just started listening as if I was a member rather than just a visitor. And I'll tell you what, the fellowship became a much more friendly place. It wasn't just a place to go drink coffee and hear interesting stories. I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and began to own all my defects, and my life became my fault. I was no longer a victim. Out of experiencing that in the third step, took me into the fourth step, where I became honest with my sponsor to a level that I'd never been honest with anybody. And it turns out I'm not the worst turd in the bowl. Thought I was the worst turd in the bowl. I was sure that you know, there had been some things that would definitely explain why I was insane and why I was different. And my sponsor wasn't impressed at all. Wasn't impressed at all. He actually said he was a little disappointed. He says, for people that are as psychotic as you, I would expect a lot more skeletons in your closet. Are you sure there's nothing more? No, that really is it. And I got excited by his question because I was like, we're on to something. Because he could accept me. Therefore, I wasn't completely fragmented. That there wasn't some magic missing thing, that I wasn't, a Prozac pill short, or I wasn't short, I needed some simple salt sugar thing to make me complete. Turns out he had the same stuff and he was reasonably happy, so I had something to work for. And I got tremendous relief out of his acceptance of my complete and utter insanity. It began to amuse him, and he was easily amused, but it began to amuse him. I'll give you an example. We were on our way to a meeting, and I just happened to be driving. And back then, I was a reasonably angry young man. As I said, I had that shotgun, and I never old ideas die very hard with me. And really, old ideas could be new ideas that just stopped working. But I had lots of old ideas in the back seat of my truck. In the form of a billy club, a shotgun, knives, that kind of stuff. You never know. You never know when you need to be ready. You never know. And every once in a while, you keep trash in your car. It's not really trash. It could be ammunition, right? So I have this ammunition / trash, cigarettes, and weapons behind my trunk. And anyway, my sponsor, I was just hanging out with my sponsor, getting all spiritual. And he sends me the meeting, and he's got another new guy. And I go out to the meeting, and sure enough, there I pass, and on the side of the road is this nearly dead squirrel, and, well, that's sad. I mean, there are people there. What should we do? What should we do? I pull over, and there's the squirrel, and it just, half of it had been run over. So I open up my trunk, and I get out, and I pull out one of my old ideas, and there I am with this iron or this this lead-filled billy club, and I'm like, I know what to do. Trust me, it's not pretty. You need to put it out. I'm going to go ahead and do it. They're like, really? Yeah, you should. And everybody's like, yeah, go ahead. So I take it back in the woods, and there I am at the side. And by now, there's like cars stopping. And here I am with my old idea, just smacking this squirrel. And just then, my sponsor pulls up, rolls down the window. He's like, Chris, just get to the meeting. Rolls his window back up and drives off. That is a picture of what I was like. And to me, it made perfect sense. But shortly thereafter, those old ideas in the back of the car, she broke up with me. And those old ideas started to become very new ideas. And I had a brother pigeon of mine that just cleared out all my weapons. And so on came the fifth, sixth, and seventh step. That's a sure way, beeline to it. Just get out of a relationship. Sixth and seventh step right there, you can just see it just glaring, just resentment. But you can't have a resentment because, you know, they're living rent-free in your brain, and I can't have them living rent-free, and I'm mad as hell because they're living rent-free. And where's my rent? You know, and just feeling everything intensely. 17 years old. 17, 16, 17 years old. Just knew it driving, and I didn't know anything about it. Actually, I was probably 18 at that time. And through 6 and 7, 8, 9, and 10, steps 8 and 9 came reasonably quickly in my sobriety. You see, my father never did find Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sister moved away. And my father stayed reasonably sick. In fact, he did ultimately have another heart attack. And what happened was, I was 17 years old and going to meetings almost every single day, and he didn't fully support that. And he would just give little comments like, "Do you really have to go to meeting every day?" Just little stuff. And I didn't know the answer to the question. I would want to say, "Dad, I don't think so." Well, why don't you stay home and do some homework? You can do much better in school. You're reading a lot more, I notice. You know, things look like they're kind of going your way. Why don't you cut back on the meetings and, you know, kind of hang out with us a little bit more? I became attractive to hang out with. That was the good news out of that. Now, granted, had I done that and had I cut back on the meetings and really started patting myself on the back, well, we all know what can happen from that. But, I had a sponsor. And he showed me the gift in what he was asking. I took it as, you know, don't go to those meetings. And I'm like, Dad, you're trying to kill me. You know, it wasn't nothing like that. Well, eventually he did have another heart attack. And what happened was, just before that heart attack, I came home one night. And it all became very clear. He didn't expect me home. For whatever reason, my mother wasn't there either. And there he was, sloppy drunk, falling down in the bedroom. I guess he'd been drinking all along. I don't know. I didn't really look for it. I was too self-centered and too concerned with myself. But when I got home, indeed, he'd been drinking. I never told my mother about that, ever. She was under the impression, as a good Al-Anon is, and she wasn't really looking for it either. But I saw him sloppy drunk. And he went into bed, and he's, you know, he knew I knew. I knew he knew I knew, but we weren't talking about it. He asked me how the meeting was, and he lied in his bed there. I know he was watching David Letterman or something, and he said, "You know, Chris, I'm really proud of you." And he said that completely sloppy drunk. But he said the same thing when he was sober, so I know he meant it. I know he meant it. The same thing happened to his father. Well, about 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later, I stood in his hospital room and watched him take his last breath. And still, around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that was one of the most difficult things I've experienced up until that point, for a father to watch his son die. However, it's a hell of a lot better than the alternative, because he came very close to watching me. And it should never be the other way around. It happened exactly the way it's supposed to happen in my experience. In working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it became a gift. Not the gift because my father died or because he fell victim to whatever he died of, but simply because I was there present and sober. That's why it was a gift. And there I was with my sister. And my brother. My brother's not an alcoholic. My sister is. We were there shoulder to shoulder, all present for this with my mother. Interesting thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up getting a card from my home group. And now it's funny because I could tell they put this card around the meeting. So it started over here and it probably ended over there. And there's, you know, it starts off, so sorry for your loss, you know, very sorry, I'm here for you, you know. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, way to go, congratulations, huge congrats on, you know, time. And then all of a sudden it turned into like this anniversary card. So it started off, sorry for your loss, to huge congrats, way to go, wahoo! And I get this card, and nobody read it, and I show it to my family. And we just rolled. We laughed. My father had a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. He was a great man. I love my father. He had great jokes. And really, he was definitely well-loved by his peers. And we ended up sharing that card at his funeral, and I developed a very, very close relationship with my mother. And all this has everything to do with steps 8 and 9, but ultimately my mother developed breast cancer, which is one of the most horrific things I've ever witnessed in my life. I don't have too much to say about that because it's pretty horrific. But I developed such a close relationship with my mother. She was my best friend. We used to talk about everything. She taught me how to be married well before I'd ever been married, how to be a husband and a father before I'd had ever experienced that stuff. Even still today, I recall a lot of our conversations. The deal was that she was always present for this stuff, but because of sobriety, because of steps 8 and 9, I became able to listen to this, and we developed a relationship which was absolutely unparalleled other than the relationship I had with my sponsor. That was the common denominator to this whole thing. My ability to be present for my sponsor allowed me to be present and available for my family. Now, that's just my own experience. And perhaps I put too many eggs in the sponsorship basket, but that's just flat-out experience. And so the closer and the more contact that I would have with the sponsor, the more able I would be to be present with the family. And oftentimes it made family vacations. Where's Chris? He's at a meeting. Guess he missed the dinner. But you know what? I'm there, and I'm after the dinner, and they're drinking coffee, and I'm fully present. And the same thing happened in the relationship with my mother, and she loved it. She loved Alcoholics Anonymous. She loved what was happening. She watched me. We became such good friends. She watched me. I went from this, you know, having this little kind of retarded class thing to, you know, she was the one that was picking me up from school and taking me to the proctologist to go get the upper and lower GIs. I mean, she knew everything about me, and she knew the nature of my disease. She knew what alcohol did for me. She wasn't stupid. She was a black belt in Al-Anon. The fact is she just kept a lot of that stuff back, but we developed this relationship, and then she got to watch. She's the one who dropped me off. I can't imagine today. I have a 2-year-old. I can't imagine today taking my 2-year-old and completely turning her will and her life over to the care of Carlton, the big giant black linebacker who's going to play ping pong and might kick the living crap out of my son. I can't possibly imagine that, but that's exactly what she did. And that's a huge amount of love. And she got to watch, she watched me, I had a dream. After I'd been sober a couple of years, I was running with this guy, Hal Marley, and listening to guys like Hugh McGee and some of these guys that have been sponsored by. I benefited from the work of a man by the name of Buck Doyle, who I don't know. The reason why I know the name is because he sponsored a ton of these dudes. That's how I know that name. And there I am with Hugh, and Hugh, or actually Hugh McGee, senior son, and he's talking about owning dreams. You have to. You don't want to sell out on your sobriety. Own your dreams. And I let him know. I said, hey, man, I want to fly airplanes. And I was almost embarrassed to tell him. And what happened was, is I told my sponsor, and he sent me to the airport. And he says, go find out how to be a pilot. And I went to Dulles, and I asked the captain. I said, how did you do what you do? And I joined the military. Went to the military. They said, hell no. So I wasn't going to give up there. He wanted me to be tenacious, so I went out to Manassas Airport, and I ended up getting all my licenses out there, all the way up through my airline transport pilot rating. And my mother watched all of this. She watched me with my first corporate job, my first airline job. She spotted me the $7,000 because you had to pay for airline jobs back then because nobody was hiring. And she spotted me the $7,000 and $10,000 and gave me as much money as she could. I drove as many pizzas and made as many meetings. I mean, I just had a crazy schedule, but a lot of energy. And ended up going to college, and she watched all this stuff. And she let me be her son and be a caregiver when she passed. I was with her up until the very last moment. The very last moment, so the point where she closed her eyes. Hospice is a wonderful, wonderful program. Wonderful program. And she died very reasonably comfortably. She wasn't wondering. My father wasn't wondering. That's never happened in the history of men in my family, I can assure you. To the point where she was at my wedding. My mother was at my wedding. And there's a picture, and it's my favorite picture. It's one of my favorite family pictures, an eighth and ninth step picture, because what happened was the breast cancer stripped everything, and they came up with this new procedure. My mother just had this. She got herself this gigantic implants, I guess, sort of, but she had this really low-cut dress, and she looked so unbelievably happy between me and my wife, and she's looking totally, I mean, it's my mom. She's like looking years younger. She's doing great, and there she is with my wife now, and I, and that's the result having nothing to do with me. I got to have that relationship. That relationship's fully complete. And if that's not a beautiful story to you, that's okay. It is to me. It's a beautiful story because the relationship's fully complete. The beginning, the middle, and the end. All beautiful stories have those three components. Now, I guess what I want to say to where I'm at today is I'm in the middle. As all stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I'm right smack dab in the middle, and I am loving it. Contrary to what I ever thought possible. Coming from the kid that, you know, my only solution was suicide. And I remember how easy it could have been to just end it all. I remember the mentality. Just that on that jumping off point that it talks about in the big book, where the four horsemen are there. And I'm not entirely sure what it is that is the difference between me and my friend who, well, she just shot herself in the head this last week. I just found out about it. I find out little things. One of the things about coming around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a while is you get to see what happens to people that don't come around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. But that's not what keeps me here. That's not at all what keeps me here. What keeps me here is watching what happens to people that do keep coming around, watching that stuff. Now, I tell you the story, and I'm sort of amazed at Alcoholics Anonymous, and those relationships are complete, and I have a vision of how that is, but I'm almost telling it to you almost in the third person. Because I don't take credit for any of that. Now, yeah, I got to occupy a lot of that space, but the three things that surround all of that are more important than that two-year-old that wanted to watch Mary Poppins this morning at 2 in the morning. And 3:30, my wife, I tell you what, I have huge respect for women and Alcoholics Anonymous children. I'm a wimp when it comes to that type of stuff. My wife is a trooper, man. And she sponsors people, and she's active in AA, but we have this two-year-old who is just very similar to me in the sixth grade, actually. And you know what? She has little yellow teeth. She has little yellow teeth. She doesn't have any enamel, but it's just on her baby teeth. They think that her adult teeth are going to have enamel on it, but I'm reminded. Her middle name is my mother's first name. My daughter's name is Kelly Judith Dugan. My mother's name was Judy Dugan, and every bit of spirit is there. I'm in the middle of the story. I'm not looking forward to an end of my story, but I love the middle of my story because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it could turn on a dime. The story could turn any which way but loose. I stop going to meetings. I start patting myself on the back. I stop sponsoring people. There's a number of things that can happen. But today, here I am. I stand as a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an active member of my home group, the Midtown Group, taking nothing from the neck up to make me feel better. And I'm current with my sponsor. And his name is Mike. His sponsor's name is Johnny. His sponsor's name is Clancy. And it's kind of a mystery from there. We have our suspicions where Clancy goes. We don't ask questions. If you find out, let me know. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never thought that would come to pass. So there's the greatest story, or I guess the greatest lesson that I can see in the traditions is at the end of the 12th tradition in the long form, it says, this to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever remain in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank you for having me here.